Hi.
Hi.
Yeah. So, my name is Russell, and I'm a psychology professor at Eastern Washington University, and I do a little bit of work on in the area of compassion and compassion-focused therapy. And so, there's a fair bit of overlap between what I do and Tibetan Buddhism and the sorts of things that happen here. So my, as I mentioned, my area of focus really is compassioning a therapy model called compassion-focused therapy. And compassion-focused therapy, or CFT as we call it, was developed by a psychologist in England named Paul Gilbert. And it's sort of equal parts evolution science, affective neuroscience, understanding how emotions work out in the brain, behavioral science, and Buddhist psychology. I don't know if you would have heard anything about this since you've been here, but what we're finding is that there are a lot of scientists that are beginning to verify the sorts of things that Tibetan Buddhists have been talking about for many years now, in terms of how the mind works and things like this. So that's really nice, and that's one thing that drew me personally to Tibetan Buddhism was the openness to science and scientific ways of understanding things, and that's not always the case. So let's talk a little bit about compassion and do some exploration around that. So how many of you, probably all of you, have heard this word compassion and maybe thought about it, maybe even some this week? Would anyone like to give me kind of a definition or just a brief description of your understanding? When you hear this word compassion, what do you think? What comes to mind?
Yeah. Wanting to, sentient beings to be free of suffering.
Yeah. Yeah. So this focus of desiring beings to be free from suffering. Anything else? Yeah, so empathy. Empathy is really having understanding of people's experience, particularly emotional experience, and perhaps being motivated to care about that. Absolutely, that's part of compassion. Anything else that come to mind? One of the things I'm happy not to hear here, but sometimes when I'm talking about compassion to people who are in prisons or veteran populations or things like this, there's a sense that compassion is something that's sort of soft or fluffy or indulgent, right? It's just sort of about being nice all the time and being sweet to everybody and giving everyone what they want and things like that. And that's a real misconception. There's actually a therapy practice in Spokane. And it's a wonderful group of therapists. I'm not going to name it, but I hate their motto. I'm not very fond of their motto at all, because their motto is something like, where courage meets compassion. And the reason I don't like that motto is it implies that compassion is devoid of courage by itself. And when you spend much time thinking about and practicing compassion, what one discovers is that courage is probably, along with kindness, the core of compassion. Because, remind me your name again, sir.
Clinton.
As Clinton sort of led us off with, compassion only exists in the presence of suffering. Does that make sense? Compassion is dependent upon suffering because it arises in response to suffering. Compassion is about what we do when things go wrong or when pain shows up. Or when we struggle, or when others, you know, when we see things that are really troubling, disturbing, uncomfortable. And compassion is about meeting that with, as you folks have mentioned, with empathy, with kindness, and with the motivation to alleviate that suffering, and perhaps even to try and prevent it in the future. So I think this is really important to recognize that compassion is not just about being, like, nice all the time. Certainly kindness is a huge part of it, but the essence of compassion, the beginning of compassion, is this kind of courageous willingness to turn toward difficulty and suffering and challenge. Historically, and I think this is true of Buddhist contexts as well as Western contexts, when people have talked about compassion, they've really meant compassion for others, right? The compassion that flows out from us to other beings. And more recently, in the field of psychology and psychotherapy, there's been this sort of awareness that, in the West at least, that has often resulted in people perhaps excluding the self from their compassion. So, and I've met many therapists who actually are quite good at extending compassion to other beings. They care very much about others and helping them, which in many cases is why they became therapists. But they really struggle when it comes to themselves. They really struggle when they sort of observe their own challenges or difficulties or maybe emotions that they're less comfortable with. Maybe I'll go through a little vignette to give you a sense of what I'm talking about. So what I'll do is I'll just describe a situation, and I'll ask you a couple stupid questions and maybe one not so stupid one, right? So I want you to imagine that there's a child that you love very much. Maybe this is your child or a niece or a nephew or a neighbor, or, you know, this is a kid that you know and that you care about very much and that you want to be happy and okay, right? And I want you to imagine that this child is learning an inherently just a really difficult task. They're learning something that's really sort of hard to master. So do we have any tennis players in here? You want to play tennis? Tennis is really hard, like much harder than it looks. Like if you look at people playing tennis, it doesn't seem like it would be that hard. Trust me, this is very difficult. So imagine you've got a child who's trying to learn to play tennis, or maybe trying to learn like a new language or a musical instrument, you know, something that's very difficult initially and requires a lot of struggle to master and to improve at. So I'd like you to imagine this child having one of two teachers. On one hand, we can imagine the child having a critical teacher. Hopefully you've never had a teacher like that, but I hear from lots of people that sometimes they have. You've got a teacher who somehow has learned that the way to help others learn is by being really hard on them, right? Just really keeping on them, and that's how to motivate people. This teacher somehow learned this. So we can imagine how this critical teacher might engage with the child as they struggle with this very difficult task. So, no, no. No, what's wrong with you? Can't you do anything right? No, not like that, stupid, like this. No, why? God, I don't even know why I bother with you. No, no, no. All right, so that's teacher number one. So, on the other hand, I want you to imagine this child that you care very much about having a compassionate teacher. And I want you to imagine that this compassionate teacher has various qualities that tend to be present in compassionate teachers. So this teacher is kind. She or he is not only concerned about the child learning the task, but is concerned about the well-being of the child. They want the child to be happy and healthy. This teacher is wise. The teacher understands that when approaching a difficult task in the beginning, particularly that the real goal is to keep the child struggling, right? Knowing that that's how we get better, that actually these are difficult tasks, involve us all kind of struggling for a while, and if we just keep struggling, eventually we get better. And imagine that this teacher is confident as well. The teacher knows that if they can keep the child struggling, that the child will get better with time and practice, right? So the teacher's confident. If I can just keep the child struggling at this, they'll get better, they'll learn it eventually. So we might imagine how this compassionate teacher might engage the child in maybe a very different manner than the critical teacher. Right. There you go, just like that. Yeah, that's it. No, not quite that, oh, more like that. Yeah, that's it. There you go, keep going. I'm really proud of you. This is a really tough task and you're working so hard. There you go, just keep it up, you'll get better. Right, so two teachers. Can you imagine, right, a child with those teachers? So first, a couple stupid questions. So which teacher would you prefer that this child you love very much have? Just hold up your finger, one or two. So I'm seeing lots of twos, that's good. If you were holding up ones, I would say you might be on the wrong retreat, right? You might be in the wrong place. So let's say, question two here, let's say just, you know, just for funsies, let's imagine that actually this isn't a child that you particularly care about, you know, except insofar as you care about children broadly. You don't have any sort of special relationship with the child. You don't even really know the child very well, right? But you're invested that the child learned the task, right? Maybe you need, an extra player to complete your group's tennis team or, you know, whatever it is. You're committed to them learning the task, but don't have any sort of special relationship to the child. So again, if you'd hold up a finger, one or two, indicate which teacher you'd prefer this child to have. Okay. So again, it's twos all around. So now you've told me that whether your motivation is the well-being of the child, caring about the child, or it has to do with the child mastering the task and getting better and doing well, that you think the compassionate teacher would do a better job. Correct? Can we sort of agree on this? Yeah? So, last question. When you observe yourself struggling, which teacher does the voice in your head most sound like? So I see some ones and some twos. So, it's... yeah, I see a lot of that, right? That's good. The two flickers in, you know. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
You just did. Go ahead, yes. Sorry.
I'm thinking of NBA coaches.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't think of a lot of twos.
No, no, you can't, can you? No.
For the top excellent teams.
No. Steve Kerr, maybe? Maybe? Yeah. I don't know. I don't see too many coaches on the sidelines, right? I think there are different ways to be a compassionate coach. I think sometimes what we see isn't always the best representation, but I think you're right. I think in a lot of sports, the first teacher is the one that's most frequently modeled, right? I think in a lot of people's minds, the first teacher is really present. And I think that that's not by accident. I think that if we look out into the culture, and probably a lot of this is driven by advertising, I think there are a lot of messages that kind of are woven into the fabric of the culture that say, you shouldn't struggle. Right? You should sort of be happy all the time. And if you're not happy, if you're sad, or if you're angry, or if you're anxious, or you're afraid, then that means there's something wrong with you, and you need to do something about it very quickly to get that sorted. Has anyone ever gotten that message? And it may be a message that you can say, yeah, you can identify it really easily. But it may also be simply just this sort of almost conditioned reflex you have when an emotion shows up, right? When fear or anger or sadness or whatever it is that you've learned you're not supposed to feel shows up. And instead of going, oh, look at that, you go, whew. And do whatever you can to divert it, to not feel that thing. How many of you have that thing that you work really hard not to feel sometimes? Right? Or maybe that thing that when it shows up, it triggers experiences of shame. Like, I'm not supposed to feel that. That means something that's bad about me. I was on this Facebook, just anecdotally, I was on this Facebook group for men that I joined. And it's an interesting group because it's a group, I won't name it, but it's an interesting group because it's a group of really like right-wing, big pickup driving, gun-toting, flag-waving guys, right? And the group, the reason I joined it primarily is that the group is also devoted to trying to contribute to the community and being better men and things like that. And I thought, okay, this is pretty cool. And I joined it. It was very important that I not be sort of clandestine about it. I was very honest when I joined. I said, you know that liberal college professor that everyone tells you is going to, you know, spoil the mind of your youth, right? I'm literally that guy. but when they discovered that I said, if you're about being, you know, better men and contribute to your community, you know, sign me up, that's fine. But it's very, very kind of uber right-wing sort of context, which for me is not kind of my pocket. That's not really where I live. So I got in there, and I remember it was 2 or 3 months ago. There was a discussion about toxic masculinity. Somehow that had come out in the culture. Something had happened in the culture where toxic masculinity was kind of bandying about. And I remember on this page, I went on there, and someone brought up toxic masculinity, and people were just rolling with it. They were talking like, yeah, you can't be a man anymore, and this is a war on men, and just kind of rolling with it. This toxic masculinity was just like an excuse to go after guys, and I intervened a little bit there, and I've kind of earned my way in to do that for whatever reason. They've kind of let me, given me some bandwidth to do this kind of thing. So I said, guys, let's just calm down a little bit here. First, what is masculinity? Right? Masculinity is just kind of the set of ideas that our culture has kind of agreed upon about what it means to be a man. Does that make sense? I mean, that's all it is. It's just this collection of ideas that there's this kind of implicit agreement, right? Nobody sat down and said, let's decide what this is, right? And we just kind of got this implicit agreement that this is what it means to be a man. And of course, we have these ideas about women, too. People, some of the guys on the group said, yeah, but what about toxic femininity? And I was like, well, yeah, that's it, true. But typically toxic femininity only hurts the woman that's experiencing it and doesn't hurt everybody else. So we don't talk about that nearly so much. I said, what if toxic masculinity is just this sort of collection of ideas, or if masculinity, rather, is just this collection of our culture's ideas, kind of what we've agreed upon about what it means to be a man, then all toxic masculinity means is that some of those ideas aren't helpful, right? That maybe some of our ideas about what it means to be a man aren't helpful. And I said, if you've ever felt weak or ashamed when you cried or felt scared or felt sad, then you've experienced toxic masculinity. And it was interesting because these guys went from, you know, just railing to, oh, fair enough, okay, thanks. I've totally experienced that. And it was interesting to see that flip because I think, but it was something that they could immediately identify with, how they had internalized, and some of it's from the culture, and some of it's from our primary caregivers, and some of it's from all over, you know, wherever you get it, probably advertisers. They'd internalize this idea that there, you know, there are certain ways that it's okay for me to feel. And then there's this stuff over here, right? There's this stuff that it's not okay for me to feel. There's this stuff that if I feel it, or if I think it, or if I whatever, that means something bad about me. That means I'm not okay in some way. I think a lot of us have that. I think a lot of us have somehow learned that there's some aspect of our experience that it's not all right for us to have. And so I'd ask you, just to reflect a moment, how many have you had that? I mean, are there things that, aspects of your experience that when it shows up, you're like, and you turn away from it. It's like, oh, I'm gonna change the channel. Right? Or I'm gonna go for a run, or I'll drink a beer, or I'll do whatever I do that helps me not feel that thing. Well, it turns out that if you look at a lot of the most common forms of what we might call mental illness or emotional disturbances, startlingly close to the core of those problems is this dynamic we're talking about, is this unwillingness to allow certain aspects of your experience to be there. Right? The unwillingness to engage or to be able to work with fear, anger, whatever. And typically, when people really struggle, if you've heard of anxiety disorders, you can talk about those as disorders of avoidance. What happens is we create entire lifestyles around not having to feel that and not having to be in the situation that prompts us to feel that. And I want to make it very clear that there's nothing blaming about exploring this. It's not like we're setting out to develop like a crippling anxiety disorder or something. Actually, it's very almost instinctive in us. You know, what happens if you accidentally set your hand down on a hot oven or a hot plate on the stove, right? A hot element. You pull that sucker right off, right? You don't think about it, do you? It's not like, well, this is probably going to cause severe damage to my hand if I leave it there. I wonder what I should do. Right? You don't do that. You yank that thing off of there because it's uncomfortable. And we sort of know that that pain is a signal that we need to back off that. The problem is we tend to do that with our emotions too. Right? And so if you look at these different forms of emotional disturbance, at the startlingly near the core of those things is this dynamic. People tend to relate to those emotional experiences in one of two kind of basic ways. The first is through avoidance, just like pulling away from it really quickly, trying to distract yourself, and then sort of building your life around not having to feel that. So, for example, people who are socially anxious, it's being increasingly easy to be socially avoidant in this culture, right? If you have a Wi-Fi connection and a credit card with a high limit, you literally never have to leave the house. Right? You can have everything delivered that you need to live. The problem with avoidance, the problem with dealing with fear via avoidance, is that the more we do that, the more successfully we do that, the more we, today I don't feel uncomfortable because I don't come face to face with any of that stuff, the scary that stuff gets. Right? It's like we're training ourselves to be very vigilant in dealing with whatever that is and avoiding it. So the more we avoid what we're scared of, the more fearful it becomes. And so I think we're getting a lot of people who are sort of losing the ability to connect with aspects of their lives because it's getting easier and easier to avoid. The other thing we tend to do, by the way, that's unhelpful in terms of working with those uncomfortable emotional experiences is that we tend to criticize ourselves for having them. So instead of seeing the pain as a sign that, I need some care. The way we would with somebody else, right? If we saw someone else who was afraid, I think most of us would want to reassure them. Most of us would want to be there for them. If we see someone else who's sad, perhaps we'd want to comfort them, right? Or just let them know that someone cares, right? Someone cares. That's huge. Just having someone there with you while you're suffering. It's hugely powerful. But all too often when we see those experiences in ourselves, instead of doing that, instead of thinking, what does this like vulnerable version of me need? What would help with that? We see it as a sign that there's something wrong with us. We see it as a sign that we're not enough, that we haven't got it figured out yet. Does anyone resonate with that? Right, a tendency to be a little self-critical or things like this. One of the things that really drew me to Buddhism, actually, is kind of an immediate sort of antidote to that. I mean, a big part of psychology these days, we were wrong. I mean, the field of psychology was really wrong-headed about this for many years. We kind of bought into the idea that uncomfortable emotions were things to be gotten rid of. Does that make sense? And for years in psychology, it was kind of what the model. The model was people come in, it's like, we'll help you feel less sad. We'll help you feel less anxious. We'll help you feel less afraid. And so we developed all these treatments that were designed to do that and developed all these drugs that were designed to get rid of those feelings. And surprise, surprise, it turns out that that's not a very helpful way to approach difficult emotions. And the reason is that we don't have these feelings by accident. We don't have these feelings by random happenstance. These difficult experiences, these emotions we feel for a reason. If you look through the lens of evolution, it's very clear why we have these experiences. And it's very clear that they're not something that's wrong with us. And I think one of the things about Tibetan Buddhism that drew me is this recognition that to live means that sometimes we're going to suffer. That sometimes we will come into contact with pain. Sometimes we will be uncomfortable. Sometimes we will not have things turn out the way we like. And that's just sort of the way of it. You know, it's sort of, I like to call it the price of admission if you're going to have a human life. Right? So we're going to be uncomfortable a fair bit of the time. We all get old. We all die. We all lose people we love. You know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think part of what can really set the stage for compassion is the acceptance of that. The acceptance that this is the way the world we live in, this is the way it works, that pain and struggle and discomfort and suffering shows up. And at that point, we have a choice. We have a choice what to do about that. We can, like, distract ourselves with a million different things and pretend it's not happening and just try not to think about it. We can criticize ourselves or the people who are suffering, which might make us feel a little less threatened in the immediate sense, but overall tends to make things worse as well. Or we can look at it and go, wow, this is really hard. Right? We can take a compassionate approach that actually recognizes that this really hurts. This is really uncomfortable. This is really difficult. Understands that it makes sense that sometimes we face situations like this, and then to ask, given this, what would be helpful? And actually, what I'd like you to walk away with, if you only take one thing away from today, I'd like it to be two questions. I want to compress everything I know about compassion down into two questions, if I could. So, the first, I'd like you to bring to mind a situation in which you've struggled recently. It doesn't have to be super recently. It can be a situation that you've struggled with historically as well. But for the purposes of this exercise, pick something manageable. Don't pick something that, you know, if you really come into contact with it, will wreck you for the next half an hour. You know, some of us have those sort of traumas and things like that that are really tricky. But just bring to mind a situation you've struggled with. Maybe in which you felt emotions that made you very uncomfortable. Or perhaps you responded in a way that doesn't really fit with the version of you that you're comfortable with, right? You reacted, behaved, or thought, or felt in a way that isn't really consistent with the kind of person you want to be. Or, you know, when you kind of reflect back on this experience, you kind of cringe. Does everyone have something like that? Like something you struggle with? Yeah, if you don't, just sit there and just feel good about that. Right? Just be like, yeah, I'm doing all right. I don't have any struggles. That's great. Feel good about you. So I'd like to ask you a question. This is question number one. Given what you know about you, what you may know about just, you know, generally having a human life and how our brains work and all that stuff, but most particularly, like what you know about you in terms of maybe how you grew up, what you learned from the people around you, from the experiences you had, the stuff that happened to you, how your caregivers interacted with you, you know, what they prepared you for, what they didn't, and all the other stuff that's happened in your life. Given all of that, as you consider this experience that you struggle with, does it make sense that you would struggle with this? Because after all that about your life, does it make sense that you would struggle with, like, exactly this situation, that would be something that's hard for you? I'll give you a hint. The answer to that question is always yes. Because our struggles occur within contexts, right? And those are contexts, life contexts, contexts, biological contexts. So, what was it like to notice? Oh yeah, it makes sense that I would struggle with that. Yeah, it makes sense that that would be hard for me. How did that feel to sort of make that awareness? Did it feel any kind of way?
Yeah. Kind of felt like I was almost zooming out of my life because I was seeing it in a wider aspect.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, some people call that kind of diffusion. You know, you kind of shifted perspectives a little bit into an observing perspective, going, oh yeah, of course I would struggle with that. In Western psychology, we'll often talk about mindfulness in that sense. Mindfulness, that ability to direct our awareness to our own experience in that way, that gives us a little space between us and the acuteness of whatever that kind of tricky bit is. Anything else that you noticed? Kind of as you came to that awareness that, oh, yeah, it makes sense that I would struggle with that. Any feelings that came up around that? Yeah.
There was this sense of softening.
Yeah.
Instead of criticizing, it was like, oh, okay. Almost like going back to that example of the child, you know, like,
yeah.
Oh, like this is someone like I understand and kind of care for.
See, that's really important. Mm-hmm. Remind me your name.
Stacy,
thank you. It will take me probably 3 hours to learn your names, and then, of course, I'll get in my car and I'll drive away, but I'll do my best. So Stacy points out something very important, which is you said there was a softening, right, of maybe the criticism that might have been there before. But it sounds like there was also a part of you that almost shifted into a compassionate response or a compassionate perspective of that suffering version of you to go, oh my gosh, look at her. That really was actually really hard for me. Am I capturing it? Yeah. And that's really the goal of that kind of question, is to take that struggling version of you and to shift perspectives in relation to her or him from, yeah, that's something that's bad, it's not okay for me to struggle, to, oh, of course. Right? The same way we would anyone else that we really cared about, that we saw struggling for really good reasons. And that's the beginning, can be a beginning for compassion. You kind of look at the struggle, but not in a blaming way, but in a way that makes sense of it, that goes, oh, of course, this would be hard. So that's question number one in my compassion pair of questions. The second is, given that when you look back on that situation, that you struggle in that situation or such situations, and it's not your fault. It makes sense that you would struggle, given everything that's happened. Given that, what would be helpful? And that's the question to ask. When you notice yourself struggling, and you recognize, okay, yes, of course I would struggle. This is very tricky. This is very hard. It doesn't feel very good. Given that this is my experience, given this, that's what's happening right now, what would be helpful? And that question, what would be helpful, can be either what would be helpful in the situation, right? What would be helpful to address that situation? But I find in my life, more often than not, it's what would be helpful to help me sort of endure whatever this difficult experience is. Because a lot of times what I get upset about is the stuff I can't change. Does that make sense? There's some stuff in our lives that it's upsetting, and so we can do something about it. So let's say that I've got some sort of minor conflict with my wife. I know what to do about that. I know how to have that conversation, right? So that doesn't stir me up too much. It's like, yeah, there's a little bump in the road occasionally, but yeah, well, we know what to do about that. But the things I get really worked up about are the stuff that, on an individual level, I can't move much. Does that make sense? Things like climate change. I am completely freaked out about climate change. Right, I really, it's deeply troubling to me, probably more than anything has ever been troubling to me in my life. And although, you know, we do what we can to try to address that, so I've dramatically cut back on the amount of meat I eat. I'm not completely vegetarian, but I'm darn close now, and I'm going to be altering my workshop schedule over the next few years to stop flying very much, because I know that's really bad, and I'm trying to do other things too. But I know that on an individual level, I can't move the dial probably almost any at all, right? If a billion of us do that stuff, then that moves the dial. But on an individual level, I can't be assured. And so that's very troubling. So a lot of times, the answer to that question, what would be helpful, isn't about changing what's kind of the source of the discomfort, because a lot of times we can't change that. It's about how do I support myself or the other, the being that's suffering, whoever that being is, how can I help them feel safe, feel supported, feel validated, feel cared about in the face of whatever this is? Does that make sense? So let's say I'm trucking along, or a random person is trucking along, and get your heart broken, right? This happens. For most of us in life, at some point, we're going to get our hearts broken, if not once, then several times. Right? And when that happens, it really hurts. And generally, there's not a whole lot you can do about it either, right? It's like, this just happened. The universe just served me one up, and it's it doesn't feel very good. So a lot of times the answer is what would be helpful there is, okay, what would be helpful? You know, what would help me be a little more comfortable while this hurts? Because it's going to hurt for a while. It's going to hurt for a while. So I would encourage you, if you take nothing more from kind of this talk today, I would encourage you that as best you can remember, as you go through life, as you see other people suffering or struggling, or you particularly see yourself suffering or struggling, that when that happens, to ask yourself those two questions. Given what I know about me, does it make sense that I would have a hard time right now? And given that, what would be helpful? Any thoughts? Would you be willing to give that a try? I mean, you could always go back to beating yourselves up. You can. That's always there, right? We could always do that. But I'd encourage you to entertain the possibility that maybe there's another way, you know, to relate to ourselves when we struggle. Some people can have some resistance to that, actually. Some people can have a hard time putting down the, kind of the self-criticism. And very often, for people who are really reluctant to give that up, who are really resistant, they'll have one of two ideas. Now, there's some people, sometimes when I'm doing compassion-focused therapy workshops or things, I'll say, well, I want you to imagine that this is a magic wand. And I just walk around the room and imagine that I could, like, if I just gently touched it to your forehead, then that self-critical voice in your head that always runs you down, right, and picks on you when you're having a hard time, would forever go silent. I just tap you on the head with this. How many of you would say, you just keep your magic wand the hell away from me? Right? Anybody? A surprising amount of people are. They're like, no, you can't take my self-critic away. Don't even think about that. Right? And there are a couple reasons for this. Most often, particularly in the general population groups, you know, the reason is people have gotten the idea sometimes the self-critic works. They have the idea that actually that's how I can motivate myself. That's how I can compete myself doing stuff. And it's because it kind of works sometimes, right? Sometimes, if you stare in the mirror and call yourself a fat piece of crap enough, you go to the gym. Not very often. It usually doesn't work that way. Usually you go to the bakery. But sometimes it seems to work. And so we can be very resistant to give it up, right? We behaviorists like to call that an intermittent reinforcement schedule, right? It's why slot machines are so addictive. Right, when you've got something that people do, a behavior that people do that only pays off once in a while, but it's unpredictable, they never stop because you always think this could be the time. Does that make sense? So self-criticism is like that. Most of the time it doesn't work. Most of the time it just makes you feel bad about yourself, but every once in a while it seems to. Every once in a while you get off the couch and you go do something, and for that reason you then think, oh yeah, well, this is good. Well, even if that's true, even if, like, running ourselves down, criticizing, attacking ourselves, or others, right? It can happen with my son, too. I've got a 13-year-old. 13-year-olds can be tricky, right? And I could probably criticize him all the time, and probably once in a while, after I criticize him a whole bunch, he might actually do something that I want him to do. And so it might be easy for me to think, oh, well, criticizing him works. That's a good motivator. That's a good way to keep him going, right? The problem is, there's some assumptions in there. The first problem is that the cost of that, even if it does work sometimes, is that you make whoever you're criticizing, whether it's yourself or someone else, feel pretty badly, right? You cause a lot of discomfort and unnecessary suffering. But the other part of it is there's a latent assumption in there. If you're resisting kind of giving up self-criticism because you've got the idea that my self-critic keeps me going, it's important to acknowledge that there's an assumption in there. And the assumption in there is that criticizing ourselves is the only way to keep us working or to keep us moving, or perhaps the best way. And I would suggest that although sort of self-criticism can maybe feel like it keeps us going, that it's not the best way. That actually that second coach that's encouraging you to keep going because there's something that's good for you, right? There's something that might be better for your life or your health or your ability to put something meaningful out there in the world. You know, that might be an equally powerful motivator that doesn't have the side effect of running yourself down and creating a miserable life. Does that make sense? So, how much time do I have here? Do you know?
Just at 12:30.
At 12:30, but we've got two sessions. Is this right? So
yeah.
How much time do I have to keep talking here? Is it till 10 or 10:15 or do we know?
10:15.
Oh, okay, good. So to give you a little bit of a background about why I think considering this sort of compassionate approach could be useful for you and for others as we kind of go through the world. Would it be all right if I talked a little bit about our brains and how they evolved and how they work? Mm-hmm. Be okay? So, in compassion-focused therapy, we tend to group the sorts of emotions and basic motives that humans have into three systems defined by evolutionary function, right? So, the idea is that these experiences we have that can be very uncomfortable, they don't happen by accident. They happen for really good reasons, evolutionarily speaking. They kept our ancestors alive so they could pass their genes on down through the millennia to us, right? So there are three sorts of emotions we tend to feel. There are a few others that don't fit so neatly into this model, but this captures most of them. So the first thing our ancestors had to do if they were going to survive and pass their genes on to us is they needed to be able to rapidly identify threats and defend themselves from them. Many of our ancestors for many, many years didn't live in the context most of us find ourselves in. This is not true of a lot of human beings on the planet. There are a lot of human beings on the planet who actually face very real physical threats on a day-to-day basis. Most of us in the West, that's not generally the case. I think for most of us, a lot of times the threats we face are more nuanced social threats, things like that. But the whole idea is if we consider our ancestors who lived in this world of very real physical threats, the first thing they had to do to stay alive is to be very good at identifying stuff that was dangerous and then responding to it. And so if we consider, what are some emotions that come to mind for you when you think about that are there to help us identify and respond to threats, things that threaten us? What do you feel? What feelings come up when you feel threatened?
Fear.
Fear is a biggie? Yeah. Any others?
Apprehension
and anxiety, kind of like fear's younger cousin, yeah. There, yeah. Fear is more about what's right now, and anxiety, apprehension is more about what could happen, right? So they're intimately linked. Other?
Anger and aggression.
Anger? Absolutely, anger and aggression. So we've got the biggies. There's one last one that doesn't come up as often because we don't feel it quite as often, hopefully. Disgust. Disgust is really, really evolved to help us create distance between us and something that would make us sick or infect us. Does that make sense? So it's about something, you know, almost if someone can make you sick, the whole, if you think about the things that inspire disgust, they're the things that would make you sick if you had much contact with them, typically. So those emotions are very powerful, and actually our brains are biased to process threats. So if you're trucking along through your life and then something threatening happens, what happens to your awareness, how you pay attention, what you think about, etc.? Right? That's exactly right. I saw a couple of you do that. It's like, we're designed to do that. It's our brain, so we focus on it. Now, have you ever had one of that happen? Maybe something happened in the morning. You get in an argument with your roommate or something bad happens. And then the rest of the day, you know, you're trying to focus on your job or your school or whatever, and your mind just keeps going back, right, to whatever that is. Well, given that the world our ancestors kind of grew up in, does it make sense that our threat emotions would work that way? Right? If you've got like a tiger that's there to attack you, you want that narrow focus, right? You don't want to get distracted. You want to be like, oh, look at the pretty flowers, right? You want to do that, right? You want to be focused on the threat. That was adaptive. So we have these brains that evolved to deal with those sorts of threats, but they serve to keep us very narrowly focused. And this is very important. It's very important for understanding when we feel threatened, but it's also very important for understanding politics. It's very important for understanding the dynamics of privilege and oppression and the way things like racism and sexism and stuff like that plays out. This is very important. When we're in threat, this narrowing of our attention, how we can pay attention, what we can notice, what we can think about, focused on the threat, is cognitively crippling. We tend to become very rigid, very poor at problem solving, very poor at empathizing. We don't really care about what's going on with other people other than maybe our people that are also perceived as threatened, right? Because that's what our brains are designed to do. It's not our fault, actually. When you're anxious, when you're afraid, when you're angry, that's not something that's wrong with you. That's your threat system. That's your amygdala. That's the threat centers of your brain working really hard to protect you because you feel threatened. This is very important. That narrowing is very important for understanding what happens when people feel really threatened and why things don't work very well. The next thing that our ancestors had to do to kind of survive and pass their genes along to us is they had to get stuff, right? They needed food, they needed shelter, they needed mates, which required social positioning, things like this, right? And so the second system we call the drive or resource acquisition system, it's basically your goal direction system. So these are emotions that serve to help us sort of focus on identified goals, to keep us working toward those goals, and to reward us when we get there. So think about anytime you're like, ooh, I want that, or I want to do that, you see excitement and interest, right? That's your drive system coming online. And that's why also when good things happen, or when we achieve goals rather, we feel good, right? So you get a raise, or you get an A on the exam, or you know, whatever happens, you move up a stage in whatever social kind of group you're in, right? You're accepted as a full monastic, right? You feel good, right? That's your brain rewarding you for working hard. And the reason that happens is that the ancestors of ours who were able to pass their genes along to us were the ones that learned how to work hard and to motivate themselves to do the things they needed to do to survive and to pass their genes on. Does that make sense? Now, that's normally a pretty adaptive thing. But just as we see in the threat, with a threat system response, when we're in drive, there is also a narrowing onto whatever the goal is, right? So that our focus of our attention and our thinking and reasoning tends to narrow in that situation too. So for example, if you've ever had a goal that you've really worked toward, right? Have you ever had something that you were really excited about that you could only think about, like the first time you fell in love and you're like, you could only, it's like the whole world shrunk down to that person. And as we get older, things happen, like, you know, when you buy your first home, right? I remember my wife and I, we bought our first home. It's our only home we ever bought, but we were buying our first home. And I remember the week we closed on that house, I could almost think of nothing else, right? I was just completely focused, right? We see actually that focus towards an identified goal can be useful and helpful, and as it keeps us moving towards those goals. But if we become too focused, if we become too connected to a specific goal, it creates problems in the rest of our lives. So some of you, for example, may have had experiences with a parent who is so focused on their job that they just, it's like the rest of the world ceased to exist, right? I'm convinced, actually, that a lot of the harm that happens in the world isn't because people get up in the morning and say, I want to cause suffering in huge numbers of people and animals. It's because people think they want what they want, and they're moving towards that, and as they focus on this, they don't think about the harm, right? Ooh, I want barbecue. So I don't think about the suffering that goes into that, right? I want this, so we don't think about that. I do occasionally at the university, I'll do talks with fraternity groups or groups of men. You know, I think that's a dynamic that's behind a lot of date rape, right? I think you get somebody who goes, that's what I want to have sex. And they focus so narrowly on the goal that all the other stuff around that just doesn't even enter their field of awareness, like signals from their partner that indicate a lack of consent. Right? It's like that doesn't fit into what I want to do, so it falls off the radar. Right? So one reason I think compassion is so important in how we work with ourselves and how we work honestly with others that we experience as difficult, right, or in situations of conflict, is that there's a third set of emotions. I think in the West we get a lot of play in terms of threat drive. Have you noticed that? Right? If you turn on the news or you turn on the, you know, any of the media, it's constant threat drive. And the reason is those systems get people moving. If I can get you angry or afraid, or I can get you really desiring something, going, ooh, I want that, it gets people moving. And it's particularly useful in getting people moving in particular ways, like getting you to vote for a particular candidate, right? Which is why if you look at the candidates, so often the message you get, it's actually a combination of threat drive. It's like, they're bad, they'll destroy the world, here's your savior, right? They'll take your guns away. This person will protect your rights, right? Threat drive. So people move. It's also a good way to sell people things they don't need, right? Your life is not very happy right now. I mean, look at yourself, right? Right? Your life's not very happy. But if you buy this cup, yeah. Threat, drive. Look at how pretty it is. Tastes good, too, in the water. Yeah, it's very refreshing. The trouble is you can't really sell people things they don't need by telling them you already have everything you need to be happy. Right? People who are in the midst of that awareness don't buy crap they don't need. You're like, no, thank you. You can keep your doodle. I'm all right. Right? So we get a lot of threat drive. But there's a third set of emotions that we don't, in culturally, we don't get experience quite so much, that in the language of compassion-focused therapy, we call the safeness or soothing system. And those are emotions like feeling safe, calm, content, peaceful. Does that make sense? So instead of the kind of the arousal that goes with threat and drive sorts of stuff, the safeness is like, and it's important to distinguish between that and just a downregulation of threat. Safeness isn't about just feeling a little less threatened. It's about going, it's about being feeling safe, feeling soothed, feeling comfortable. So for example, the guy on his porch next to the stack of the guns is going, does he feel safe? No. He has the gun out because the gun makes him feel a little less threatened, but that's a difference. And a lot of times what happens is our lives become about trying to dial down threat rather than trying to build safeness. And that's really important because if we're living out here, if we're living in threat, well, what happens when we're in threat? We're narrowed onto it all the time. On the other hand, there's something really wonderful that happens when people feel safe. And one of the tricky bits about feeling safe is that our ability to do that is highly dependent on our early relationships, like 1 to 3 years old, and how well those went. And it's really a tragedy, right, that so much of how easy it is or hard it is for us to feel safe for the rest of our life is dictated when we have almost no influence on the world. But the reason it's like that is that we really evolved to feel safe through affiliation, through connection with people who accept us and care about us and value us and relate to us in a caregiving way. And this is, you know, if we think about the origins, what His Holiness and various scientists actually talk about, the origins of compassion, they really tend to anchor the origins of compassion and caregiving to mammals really emerging into the flow of life, right? Because when mammals came into the flow of life, and some birds actually, but, you know, for many millennia, there were, you know, there are a lot of animals that survived that actually didn't nurture, right? They didn't nurture. So turtles, snakes, don't really nurture their young. They just, you know, a turtle will lay 100 eggs. And when those eggs hatch, the little turtles are basically kind of they're functional. They can kind of look out for themselves. And so you just lay 100 eggs. And in that way, even if 93 of them are eaten by predators, if, you know, 7 of them disperse, you still have enough turtles to keep making turtles. Does that make sense? So that was kind of the strategy that a lot of our evolutionary forebears, sort of before mammals came along, that's what they did. They just produced so many young that even though you don't take care of them and a lot of them dies, there are enough of them that it keeps the species going. But what happened when mammals emerged in the flow of life is you had a set of species there that were helpless, absolutely helpless at birth, and required a whole lot of care, or they would die, right? We had to develop a psychology of caring and nurturing. Mammals had to learn how to nurture, how to care for their young, or they would have been eradicated, right? Because a human infant, I mean, if you're alive as an adult human, however bad it was, and there are a lot of people who are alive and it was really bad, you had someone who at least minimally cared for you during those first 2 or 3 years that kept you alive. Does that make sense? Because it's really required. Otherwise, we just die. So the idea is that we evolved to feel safe through connection. And if things developmentally go as they should, and in about 60% of people, they do go as they should, what that looks like is during those first few years, when baby us's are distressed, the caregiver is consistently there. Right? So the infant cries, and the caregiver comes and helps out and figures out, okay, do you need sleep? Do you need something to eat? Do you just need to be comforted? But the whole idea is that caring is consistently there. And what happens when that happens, when the caring is consistently there, is that this infant learns some really important things. It learns that the outside world can be helpful. Right? It learns that when I need help, help will come. The infant learns that there are people who will take care of me. Other people can be kind. Other people can be helpful. Other people can be caring. Right? The infant also learns the beginnings of how to experience themselves as being lovable and worthy of care. This is very important. Every time we interact with another human being, we teach them something about themselves. Right? If we teach people, if we interact with people disrespectfully and with pity, we teach them that they're not worthy of respect and they're worthy of pity. Does that make sense? And we treat people lovingly and kindly, we teach them that they're worthy of love and kindness. And those messages are learned particularly strongly when we're very young. And so when that infant is receiving that caring and that love and that loving contact from caregivers when they're very young, that's how we learn to experience ourselves as worthy of love and worthy of kindness. And if we don't get that stuff, then we don't learn that about ourselves. We can learn something else about ourselves, like maybe I'm not worthy of love. Maybe I'm too much to handle. Etc., etc. Right? The other thing we learn from what the attachment researchers would call those secure attachments, when the caregiver is there consistently over time, is we learn how to care for others. We learn a model for what to do when other people are distressed. Right? So we learn all that stuff. The problem is that for about 40% of us, We don't get that. For about 40% of people, their caregivers, for whatever reason, aren't able to be there for them consistently when the child is distressed. And there are a couple ways that can play out. In one case, you can have a caregiver who's just neglectful, who maybe is caught up in their own whatever. Maybe they're depressed to the point that they can't engage with someone else in a caring way, or maybe they're caught up in a substance problem, or any number of reasons, right? Maybe they can't be there because their child is locked in a cage at the border. But when that child doesn't get that, when they're distressed and they don't receive the nurturing and they don't receive the care, they learn some very different things. They learn that help won't be there when you need it. They learn that when you're struggling or suffering, there's no soothing available, there's no help. And they learn that they're not worthy of love and affection and kindness, because when they need it, it never comes. And they don't learn how to care for others. They don't learn how to help when others need it, because they haven't seen it modeled. They don't know what it looks like. Does that make sense? People like that, in the language of attachment, and I'm using psychology attachment language, not Buddhist attachment language, right? So psychology attachment, when we say attachment, our ability to connect in these sort of relational ways with other people. That would be called avoidant attachment. And folks like this, what happens is that they can go through the world in a way that they tend to avoid close relationships with people because they've learned that it's not helpful. They don't even know how to do it. They haven't developed the skill set to actually connect. They've learned that connecting doesn't seem to be helpful. It was never there when they needed it. And one of the things that's really tricky for folks like that is they learn to not only avoid other people, they learn to avoid their own emotions. They learn to be very scared of things like fear or sadness or anger. And the reason is, you know, when you're an infant and those emotions come up, those feelings are huge and they're powerful. And the way we learn to manage them is by being nurtured, by mom or dad picking us up and holding us and saying it's going to be okay and rubbing our heads and our backs and soothing us. And what happens every time that happens, we learn that we can have these big feelings, but that it can get better as that soothing connection, that affiliation helps us, you know, soothe in the face of that. Right? And we have chemicals in our brains, like oxytocin. Right? When we have warm, soothing interactions with other people who care about us, our brains literally release oxytocin, and that oxytocin turns down the threat activation in the amygdala. It softens the fear and the anger, the anxiety, directly by acting on the parts of the brain that produce it. Right? So if our brains have learned to connect with other people in ways that get those systems going, we can regulate that threat by doing that. So when something bad happens to me, I can talk to my wife, or I can hug my kid, or I can call my buddy and go for a walk and talk, right? And I've learned that when I have those close connections, it helps me feel better. People who haven't had that experience haven't learned that. So those feelings, the fear, the sadness, the anger, are completely overwhelming. They're just swimming in it. And there's all that stress hormone and all that stuff, and that actually is not good for the brain. But the person becomes very terrified of having those experiences because the experience is, when I get in that place, there's nothing I can do that helps. Right? They don't learn how to work with it because they haven't been taught it. The other sort of tricky attachment group in terms of human relationships we call anxious ambivalent. And for an anxious ambivalent attached person, this is someone who had a caregiver who tried, but who often themselves were so dysregulated that they were unable to be consistently soothing, right? So they'd come in and they'd want to help, and they start by being very warm in terms of taking care of the child, but they couldn't handle the child's distress, so they'd freak out and make it about them. Have you ever seen that sort of situation where someone comes in and they want to help, but then they freak out and they make it about them, right? So an easy example of that, I teach a trauma course at Eastern. And, you know, I go in and I say, I want you to imagine, right, you're a parent and you've got, an adolescent daughter. And she comes home and she is courageous enough to tell you that she's been raped by her boyfriend. What do you do? What does half the class say?
Then half the class says, "I'm gonna go kill him."
I'm gonna go kill him. Yeah, they do. Half the class says, "I'm gonna go kill him." Right? So, Dad says, "I'm gonna go kill him." Does this girl feel better or she feel worse? She feels worse, right? Because Dad made it about his anger, not about her pain. Now she's got two problems, maybe three, right? I was just assaulted, and my dad might kill this person who hurt me, but who I probably don't want dead. And Dad goes to jail, that's going to create huge problems for her. Does that make sense? We just multiplied it. Dad just made it about him. Suddenly, instead of taking care of her, she's got to be thinking about taking care of him or managing the situation, right? And this can play out in a lot of different ways, but what happens is, in those attachments where you've got someone who's sometimes there but often disappears when it gets hard or gets overwhelmed or makes it about them, is that the person learns to crave, to desire connection. Not to avoid it completely the way the other person did. They want it. They learn it can be helpful, but they also learn they can't trust it. They learn that although it can feel good, it'll disappear right when you need it. You can't count on people. And maybe they learn that things like the thing, these are the folks that say things like, when people really know me, they don't want me. If you really knew me, you wouldn't want me. If you really understood what I was like, you wouldn't be here for me. And they think that because they've had those experiences, right? Where people would come in and just when they needed it the most, they disappear. Right? They weren't there consistently. Now, why am I talking so much about attachment and human relationships in the context of a talk on compassion? I'm aware I need to wrap it up in the next 8 minutes or so.
We can go longer.
Oh, no, it's okay. I want to give them a break and I want to have a discussion and maybe go outside. You know. I'm talking about it because we evolved to feel safe through those sort of relational connections, right? And there are two things really important about that. Number one, it's really nice to feel safe generally, but when we look at that safeness system, feeling safe, calm, peaceful, connected, remember when we talked about threat and drive, how it narrows our thinking and our attention, right? So a lot of that stuff that we want to be able to use, our creativity, our empathy, our problem solving, all that kind of falls off. When we feel safe, and there's all sorts of studies from various areas of science that demonstrate this, when we feel safe, the opposite happens. We open up. We can think very flexibly. Creativity goes up. Altruism goes up. Pro-social behavior goes up. Perspective taking goes up. Does that make sense? So if we want to be at our best, if we want others to be at their best, the royal road to that is to help them and us feel safe. To find ways to help one another feel safe. When that happens, we're able to think flexibly and use all of this stuff we've got. Now, that can be very tricky because, as I've mentioned, about 60% of people learn to feel safe in the way evolution designed us to feel safe, through connection with caring others. About 40% of us learned that that doesn't help, right? That you can't count on it or it won't be there when you need it. That's very tricky because you've got a fundamental conundrum. Think about this. If you're someone who evolved to feel safe through connection and affiliation, but because of the way your life shaped up, you don't. Instead, you feel threatened. You've learned to connect, particularly for people who were abused as children, may have learned to associate connection not with safeness, but with betrayal or with harm. Right? If you've learned to associate connection not with feeling safe, but with threat, then the stuff that evolution designed to help you feel safe doesn't. How do you ever feel safe? Do you see what I'm saying? If you evolve to feel safe in this particular sort of context, and yet development has kind of poisoned that context, you can end up with people who it's almost impossible for them to connect with those feelings of feeling safe and calm and peaceful. which means they go through the world in a way that's cognitively crippling. They're focused on the threat. It's always about, how do I get rid of the threat? How do I handle the threat? How we manage the threat? I think for the BBC thing at lunch, I think I'm going to speak briefly on this. We see this dynamic all over the place. You may have heard the phrase, I think I'm probably going to say almost exactly the same thing then that I'm saying now, but I want to, I think it fits with the context of the discussion we're talking about. You may have heard the phrase, if you can't beat them, join them. Have you heard this? Right? That's actually not really consistent with how we're wired up. We're really wired up more to be, if you can't join them, beat them. We're really wired up to connect, right? We really evolve to feel safe through connection. We want to connect. But what happens is when we can't connect because we don't know how, or we've not learned how, or because we don't have anyone who's willing to connect with us, then we tend to fall back on dominance management strategies. Right? If we can't join them, beat them. If I can't connect, then better that I have more power, more status, more money, so that the person can't hurt me. Right? People feel safe. People who feel safe share their resources. People who feel threatened hoard them because they don't expect that they will get help if they need it. Right? We see this in how our politics play out. If we look, and this is actually a source of compassion. I'm talking about this not to draw distinctions so you can go, those people. But in terms of understanding, if you look, studies have looked at people with far-right political beliefs. And you see neurological differences in people who are kind of far-right-leaning political beliefs. They are consistently much more threat sensitive. These are people for whom it's much easier to feel threatened. Right? So what do we do when we feel threatened? Right? We stop thinking about you. We start thinking about me and my people. We divide the world up into good and bad, and we try to hoard power, to hoard resources, things like this. I would encourage you. There's an example of someone at the very top of our political hierarchy in this country right now, who, if you look at this person, he demonstrates a lot of the strategies we're talking about in terms of making your life about attaining and maintaining dominance, right? Dominance regulation strategies. And I would encourage you, that's someone who he has, there are literally millions of photographs of him and video footage of him on the internet and everywhere. I'm not going to actually throw this out as a challenge to you because I actually don't want you spending that much time of your life, you know, like flipping through looking for pictures of these particular people. But this person, literally millions of photographs and video have been taken. I have yet to see a single depiction of him in a warm human connection. Does that make sense? I've never seen it. I've never seen him in a warm connection with another human being. And that's in stark contrast, for example, to Barack Obama. I mean, if you go on the internet, and I'm not saying this politician's good, that politician's bad, but what I'm saying, if you type in Obama on Google Images, it's almost immediately you're going to show pictures of him in a warm embrace with his children or with his wife or a warm interaction with the janitor at the White House or joking around with that person or having fun with that person. You see this ease in terms of having those warm human connections. And if you look at our current president, I've never seen it. I've never seen it. But if you see how he goes through the world, it's all about dominance. Right? It's all about how can I be up here? And that's, I say that, again, not to say this good, this bad, but to help you understand, though, that is how human beings tend to move toward when we live in a world of threat and when we're unable to connect with other people and to feel safe. Right? If I can't feel safe, better that I be more powerful. If I can't feel safe in connection with you, better that I have that. The control over the wealth, over the power, because I can't trust anyone else to take care of me. I can't trust that help will be there when I need it. So I guess in sort of closing, I'd like to encourage you to consider cultivating compassion for yourself and for others. Because when we have compassion, when we meet struggle and difficulty and pain and suffering, when we meet that with sort of kindness and kind curiosity and ask, does it make sense that I or this other being would be hurting in this way? Right? And recognize, yeah, it makes sense. That's really hard. And allow our, you know, ourselves to feel a little bit of that pain and just like, wow, that's really hard. And then we meet it with, not with condemnation or avoidance, but with kindness. Right? And this desire to figure out what would be helpful. What would be helpful? Right? How can I connect with this person in a way that would feel safe from their side? How can I engage with that vulnerable, suffering, pain, and, you know, version of me in a way that would help that version of me feel a little safer, a little more supported, like there's help available? And when we do that, when we give people that kind of gift of safeness, we help them open up, and we help bring online all that's best in them. And when we cause people to feel threatened, it does the opposite. Right? So I think that if we want to actually move past a lot of the difficulties, or not move past, but to work helpfully with the difficulties in our own lives, as well as to engage with the difficulties out in the world, that compassion is worth cultivating, because when we relate to individuals who struggle and suffer and hurt with compassion, we help them feel safe, which helps them be at their best. And there are studies that show that when we're getting that, we're also motivated to help others, right? So the best way we help people learn to help others is by helping them, by being there for them. And that's not just about helping our people, right? When I think about our current president, I actually feel terrible for him. I feel terrible. I think about that. I think about a life where you don't have any warm human interactions, where you don't have, you know, these sort of loving connections. And I think, oh my gosh, how awful that would be. You know, and then it makes sense of a lot of things. So hopefully there was something here that was useful today. So the suggestion is that as you go through life, maybe sometimes when you see yourself struggling or having a hard time with things, that you would ask a couple questions. The first one is, does it make sense, given what I know about me and what I learned and all the things that happened to me, that I would struggle in this situation? Right? Does it make sense? The answer to that question is always yes. Very nice. The second question is, given that, what would be helpful? And you notice the second question has actually got some stuff embedded in it. The given that is very important. When we say given that, what we're doing is we're offering acceptance to whatever this is. Given that, my heart is broken right now. Given that I just lost my job and I'm really worried. Given that whatever happened, there's an acceptance that, okay, this is not as I would have it, but it's how it is. What would be helpful? And maybe what would be helpful is something I can do in terms of this situation. But maybe what would be helpful is, how do I help myself be a little more comfortable as I go through this really difficult whatever it is? So I think that's that.